Chapter 16, Rebirth, Cables. In January 2002, a storm battered Land's End, the furthest tip of Cornwall where England stretches out to touch the Atlantic Ocean. Not long before the end of the road, a narrow lane leads to the village of Porthcurno. In the aftermath of the storm, strips of thick black wire were exposed on the beach like fossils, dredged up by the wind and rain. These were fragments of disused telegraph cable, remnants of the days when the beach had been home to the largest telegraph station in the world, the dots and dashes of Morse code messages flying across the Atlantic. But the storm exposed more than just the past. As well as the skeletons of their predecessors, two modern cables pulsing with life were also unearthed by the wind and rain. These were fibre-optic cables bearing beams of light which carry the ones and zeros that connect together the modern world. The modern cables that land in Cornwall surface in nondescript huts and connect into a pulsing global telecommunications infrastructure. The first international fibre-optic cable landed in Cornwall in 1988. It made landfall in a hut originally built to withstand a nuclear blast with its own 5-ton blast doors and air filtration system. As the internet took off, this cable and the many that joined it began to carry the world's emails and web browsing before these were joined by every other type of data, from downloaded movies to corporate video conferences to personal webcams, as our lives moved online and the physical and the digital worlds converged. In 2015, more than 200 million emails traversed the world every minute. A modern submarine cable can carry up to 60 terabits per second across up to 6 fiber pairs. A terabit is a trillion bits of information. In 1870, it would have taken a patient Morse code operator 37 days to send the novel War and Peace over a telegraph. Today, a fibre-optic cable could send 300,000 copies of the book every second, according to a rough estimate. In 2015, fibre-optic cables carry more than 90% of the world's data and follow many of the routes of the British Imperial Telegraph System of 100 years ago. And, just as in the First World War, Britain would learn how to exploit the cables to gather intelligence from across the world, this time as part of an alliance forged at Bletchley Park. But as it first gathered pace in the 1990s, this digital revolution marked the most profound challenge for the spies who had first exploited signals at Bletchley. The data tsunami, many inside British and American spy agencies believed, would engulf them. The internet and the digital world threatened to disrupt their business models, like those of other traditional institutions, and relegate them to the past. When you are approaching a mountain, you do not think you will be able to climb it, a former senior British official recalls. But, he adds, when you do and you get to the other side, the view can be breathtaking. Instead of being overwhelmed, the spies would learn to ride the digital wave and to master the internet, leading to what some inside that world have called the second golden age of signals intelligence. But it was not a foregone conclusion. The fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of the Cold War was a time of triumph for Western spies, but it was one that quickly led to questions as to whether they were really needed any more. GCHQ and the NSA struggled to adapt. They were static organizations because the targets they had been watching were static. One stovepipe in GCHQ would work on Soviet radio, another on Chinese satellites. An analyst might have joined in the early days of the Cold War and been assigned to monitor the signals of a particular Soviet missile battery. They might have spent the next 40 years learning every nuance of the way that that unit communicated, all so that they could listen out for the launch order, or spot something out of the ordinary that might provide advance warning of an attack. The same analyst might retire and draw their pension, never having seen such a signal. A huge intelligence-gathering machine had been built. Men clamped with headphones in far-flung corners of the planet, satellites scouring from space, dishes on Earth picking up signals. all to try to provide a few precious moments of warning. We lived on their network, is how one former British analyst described the way the US and UK enmeshed themselves inside Soviet communications. But with the end of the Cold War, this vast bureaucracy seemed redundant. And a further problem emerged at the same moment. The end of the Cold War coincided with the digital revolution. Over the 1990s, the number of internet users grew from 4 million to over 360 million. This new technology was going to be used by everyone, including the new targets that intelligence agencies were now looking at, those involved in spreading biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons, or terrorist groups, or drug barons. But finding them online would require a totally new way of working. Previously, most communications followed a fixed path that could be intercepted. The internet broke up the message into packets and then distributed them separately around the network, taking the least congested route to be reassembled at their destination. That required a different collection model. The internet was helpful on one level, as there was now only one communication system and it was transparent. There was no need to do the equivalent of stealing an Enigma machine to work out how it functioned. But the problem was that it was an open system that was moving at a bewildering pace, driven by commercial innovation. This confluence of events, the loss of the old enemy and the emergence of new communications, created an existential crisis for hidebound, inward-looking, highly secretive organizations. Were they dinosaurs about to become extinct? "We are hanging on by our fingernails," a deputy director told NSA staff in 1995. When a senator said he could learn more from CNN than from an NSA briefing, an analyst chased him down the corridor to try to disabuse him of that notion. "It will be fatal in an age of austerity to be seen as an expensive alternative to the New York Times," said an official. Budget cuts began to bite on both sides of the Atlantic. The special relationship woven at Bletchley seemed to be fraying. As the members of the Five Eyes Club shifted to looking at issues like drug trafficking, they found they were not viewing the same parts of the world in the same way as each other. The sense of a common mission was fading. Intelligence capabilities, eager for something to do, also turned more towards spying on other countries to gain national advantage. America and Europe got into a flap over a US-UK system called Echelon. This was actually the code name for collecting microwave satellite communications, but European capitals were convinced it was a program to spy on them and their companies. Former CIA director James Woolsey penned an article in the Wall Street Journal in 2000 that started by saying that "most European technology just isn't worth our stealing," before then going on to admit that Europe was indeed being spied on, mainly by the NSA, although he did not say so. But, Woolsey said, the spying was needed to catch European companies bribing foreign governments to secure contracts in places like Saudi Arabia and Brazil against American competition. "That's right, my continental friends. We have spied on you because you bribe." The volume of communications was exploding like a supernova, and encryption was beginning to spread as systems like PGP took it beyond places like banks and into the hands of the more technically adept and security-conscious members of the public. Reports started to reach the media that there was a problem in the secret world. The new digital world was shifting to fiber-optic cables, and it turned out that these could not be intercepted as easily as microwave satellite communications, where you just had to point a dish in the right direction to catch a signal which was broadcast like radio. The talk was of the NSA and GCHQ going dark and losing their ability to listen in. The dirty little secret is that fiber optics and encryption are kicking Fort Meade in the nuts, a recently retired senior CIA officer told the New Yorker magazine in 1999. "It's over. Everywhere I went in the Third World, I wanted to have someone named Ahmed, a backhoe driver, on the payroll, and I wanted to know where the fiber-optic cable was hidden. In a crisis, I wanted Ahmed to go and break up the cable and force them, the communications, up in the air. Forcing the communications of a country into the air and onto radio was what the Alert had done to German cables at the outbreak of the First World War, and now again it seemed it was the only hope the NSA might have of listening in, as had been attempted to Iraq in the 1991 Gulf War. When General Michael Hayden took over NSA in 1999, it appeared he was inheriting a sclerotic, bureaucratic institution struggling with the modern world, at once bloated and yet one in which old-timers were unable to cope with a cut of one-third of its budget since the end of the Cold War and the emergence of new technology. The failings extended to one of the new missions, finding terrorists. The NSA had been slow to take up the problem when it emerged in the 1970s. The central tension was already clear. The Soviets had their own distinct communications systems, and the NSA organized itself around targeting these, but terrorists used the same systems as the general public. Finding terrorist communications amid the vast public tide created unique problems, both of sheer scale, the needle in the haystack analogy, and culture and ethics, spying on systems used by ordinary people rather than on the unique systems of a state. It was much more like the domestic world of spy hunting, finding someone hiding amid the public at home, than the traditional foreign intelligence work of the spy agencies, studying communications of militaries and governments. There had been the odd success, such as detecting a plot to assassinate Henry Kissinger during a visit to Syria, and a plot to bomb Israeli targets in New York, but counter-terrorism had been marginal. By the late 1990s, the counter-terrorist mission had moved to the forefront, especially after the 1998 bombings of U.S. embassies in Africa by Al-Qaeda. A satellite phone belonging to Osama bin Laden was being intercepted, or at least it was until word leaked out and he switched it off, a leak sometimes blamed on journalists, although the NSA seem hardly to have been discreet, playing visitors' recordings of bin Laden talking to his mother. What intelligence was collected often sat on the shelf, waiting to be translated by the few Arabic speakers. That included a message talking about zero hour approaching. It was only translated after the 11th of September 2001, when Al-Qaeda wreaked devastation on America, killing 3,000 people in a single morning, sending the Twin Towers crashing to the ground, and even breaching that symbol of American military might, the Pentagon. The airspace was closed, but one plane was allowed to fly over the Atlantic the next day. An old freight DC-10 had taken off from a British military airfield. The plane was largely empty, save for the most senior figures from British intelligence, including the head of GCHQ. As they flew over the eastern seaboard of the United States, the spies could still see the smoke emerging from the vacant space where the Twin Towers had once dominated the Manhattan skyline. From Edwards Air Force Base, they were taken to CIA headquarters at Langley. Unlike the Americans traveling the other way during the Second World War, they bore no tangible gifts other than an offer of support. When they arrived, the Britons immediately sensed that everything had changed for their American counterparts. They inhabited a different world now. No one, at the time, had any sense of where that would lead. The sprawling U.S. intelligence community, born after the Second World War, had one overriding mission: to prevent another surprise attack like Pearl Harbor. On the morning of the 11th of September 2001, those inside the three-letter agencies felt they had failed. Accompanying the pain was a sense of responsibility, a feeling that if only they had done more, then perhaps they could have stopped the loss of thousands of innocent lives. The CIA and NSA had often swung between poles of excess and restraint. There had been plots to assassinate foreign leaders and spying on domestic anti-war activists for a while in the 1960s and 1970s. Then came revelation, condemnation, and new laws saying what you could and could not do, and senior officials desperate to avoid being hauled before Congress. After 9/11, the pendulum swung again, this time more violently. That was partly because of the utter shock of what had happened, but also because of the presence in the White House of political leaders who were determined to unleash the spy agencies. Those agencies are a tool of the executive. It issues directions and requirements, but also sets the tone for their work. And after 9/11, the Vice President, Dick Cheney, made it clear he wanted the limits to be pushed. "What more can you do?" he asked the spy chiefs, indicating his own lawyers would find a way to help. Cheney would say publicly that the country would have to take a walk on the dark side. The U.S. was deemed to be at war with Al-Qaeda, which put new powers on the table. For the CIA, this would mean secret prisons emerging, dotted across the world, into whose dark confines people would disappear. For the NSA, it meant boxes appearing in the darker corners of buildings dotted around America, into which data would disappear. Hayden's ambition was to live on the network of his target's communications, as the NSA and GCHQ had done with the Soviets. The difference was that the terrorists' network was the Internet, which was also everyone else's network. Even before 9/11, Hayden had been pushing to make the NSA a powerful permanent presence on a global telecommunications network that will host the protected communications of Americans as well as the targeted communications of adversaries. He had been arguing for bulk access to communications before 9/11. One CEO was allegedly punished by not getting contracts after he refused to cooperate in February of that year. After 9/11, the NSA was now able to move into this new space. The mantra after 9/11 was that U.S. intelligence had failed to connect the dots. It was said that the leads were there in the system, but had never been collated and followed up to understand that known Al-Qaeda members had entered the United States, one hijacker making a call from San Diego to a known Al-Qaeda safe house in Yemen. This perceived failure became the justification for a wide expansion of intelligence powers to monitor communications, even though critics would argue that the real failure was not to do with a lack of powers or connecting dots, but due to a failure to share intelligence because of bureaucratic infighting. Before the Second World War, Army-Navy competition in code-breaking had hampered the chances of spotting Japanese intentions over Pearl Harbor. Before 9/11, the CIA had not shared information with the FBI to identify the operatives, and the NSA had likewise not talked to the FBI to get a warrant on the San Diego call. A sharp line had existed to keep foreign intelligence collectors like the NSA and CIA out of the domestic spying game, but an inability to share had made that a problem. However, in the aftermath of the attack, the agencies and the White House chose to focus on new powers. Terrorism creates a demand for preemptive intelligence, finding information before a bomb goes off rather than investigating after the fact. And it is intelligence about people, not states, and those people are sometimes living within your own country. In the rush to find anyone else in the U.S. planning an attack, the previous requirement for a warrant for intercepting communications in which one party might be in the U.S. was abandoned if there was reasonable suspicion that the person was communicating with Al-Qaeda overseas. This was part of a new set of powers known formally as the President's Surveillance Program. In the past, there had been a clear distinction. The NSA spies abroad, but not at home. But now the powerful capability it had built up to target others overseas was also being turned inwards to look at the point where foreign met domestic. The fear of more attacks carried out from within was breaking down the hard divide of the past. It was now easier to monitor targets. That was one part of the new powers. But how do you find them? When Hayden had taken over the NSA, he had found it overwhelmed by volume. Rather than fight volume, he was going to swim with it and turn it to his advantage. That meant bulk access and analyzing. Get hold of as much data as you can, and then use computers to work on it. A new program involved collecting domestic phone and email records in bulk, the who was contacting whom information, rather than what they were saying. This was supposed to seek out the unknown terrorist operatives. To find the proverbial needle in the haystack, you first needed to acquire a haystack. On the weekend of the 6th and 7th of October 2001, a small number of NSA staff received a call at home. They were asked to report to work on Monday, Columbus Day, a public holiday, for a highly classified mission. Hayden personally briefed the assembled analysts, mathematicians, and programmers. He explained that the president had signed a special authorization. The aim was to provide early warning of impending terrorist attacks. It would involve a major expansion of powers into the domestic space. Hayden made it clear that lawyers had concluded this was all legal. He told the staff they would do what the authorization allowed and not one electron or photon more. The program was first called Starburst and then Stellar Wind. The president's authorization was kept in a safe in the NSA director's own office, with only a tiny handful of people allowed to see it. This was an aggressive move, an internal report found, and had been based on a view that additional attacks on U.S. soil were imminent. But what was initially a temporary response would evolve into something more permanent. By early October, a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week watch operation called the Metadata Analysis Center had been formally established. 50 computers were ordered to help with storing and processing all the data. Many of the 90 staff were veterans of traffic analysis on Russia from the Cold War, who were experts in call chaining and contact chaining. This was a particular technique that required access to bulk data about phone calls, metadata, but not the content itself. You could take the number of a known terrorist and then look at the whole data set to find whom they had communicated with directly, one hop, and then who has communicated with those people, a second hop, and even go on to a third hop. This could potentially lead you to a huge amount of numbers, up to a million in some cases. And this was where the need for skilled analysts came in, because, if used correctly, it allows you to work out which connections are significant and hopefully identify networks and unknown operatives. Perhaps you might find that person C was in contact with suspects A and B, and therefore might be a missing link. It was a technique used in foreign intelligence, but was now being applied to domestic U.S. phone calls. Many would later wonder why it was that the NSA, a foreign intelligence agency, rather than the FBI, was doing this. The reason seems to be that it was the only organization that had experience with chaining, and the only one that had the technology. The FBI was sclerotic when it came to computers. In 2012, the NSA queried the domestic telephone metadata set with 288 phone numbers, believed to be linked to foreign terrorist activity, leading to 12 tips for the FBI to investigate. Supporters of bulk collection argue that it is the only way of carrying out certain searches to find unknowns. If you do not have a full set of data, then you cannot carry out contact chaining to find unknown links, nor can you find an alternate identifier when a known target changes phone or email suddenly to avoid being tracked. It is no good, they say, looking for a needle in a haystack unless you are sure the needle is there, and that can only happen if you know you have all the hay. They say that a system that just filtered and extracted what you wanted from traffic as it went past would not have the same advantage as a full set of stored data. This is because you do not always know what will be of value until later. If a bomb goes off, they say, you want to then be able to go back and access the phone and email contacts of a suspect to see who else he was communicating with in the run-up to the event to find out if they are dangerous. It is no good just tapping his phone now. Obtaining the metadata in bulk had a crucial advantage. It meant that you could go back in time. But that requires keeping everyone's data, which inevitably means that of innocent people as well, even if, as the spies maintain, this will not be looked at. The point of the new systems was not to look at known conspirators, but to find unknowns. There was a jitteriness about America, a sense of vulnerability, and a sense that after the shock of that September morning, suddenly anything was possible. And the proponents of new programs were convinced there were unknowns out there. Overall, Stellar Wind ended up targeting around 37,000 phone numbers and addresses, about 3,000 of which belonged to Americans. Terrorism was changing the equation in terms of computers and spies, increasing the pressure to see what could be done, and pushing the boundaries of what it was permissible to do. Where were these vast amounts of phone, email, and internet data to come from? The email metadata program was later stopped. The answer was simple. The raw data would come from companies. In some cases, court orders would require them to hand over phone metadata in bulk, but they would also provide access to the communications choke points inside the US. For decades, back to the days of telegrams, these companies had provided access to international traffic. The NSA had classified relationships with over 100 companies to assist with essential foreign intelligence gathering. Two companies in particular had been compelled to provide access to large volumes of foreign-to-foreign communications transiting the US through fiber-optic cables, gateway switches, and data networks. Losing their help, NSA directors told an internal secret report, would mean the US signals intelligence system would be irrevocably damaged because NSA would have sacrificed America's home field advantage as the primary hub for worldwide communications. This so-called home field advantage in communications and data was the crux of America's intelligence capabilities. America had created the Internet and also controlled the pipes through which much of it flowed. In 2002, global worldwide data bandwidth was slightly more than 290 gigabytes per second, GBPS. Of that, less than 2.5 GBPS was between two regions that did not include the US. In other words, at that time, more than 90% of the world's data touched the United States. That made it, potentially, accessible. How much of an advantage was American dominance? Officials, even retired ones, talk in careful terms. "I don't know if I could answer that," says Richard Clark when asked what it allowed, admitting only that the fact that much of the internet traffic flowed through the US would have provided opportunity without saying if anything was made of that. "I don't want to comment on operational matters," says Michael Hayden when asked a similar question. "But I will share with you the thought that the fact that it was American ingenuity that created much of the Internet, and the fact that information was simply readily available in the American technical community, of course that helps." In other words, America understood the Internet and how it worked better than anyone else, how the routers worked and what their vulnerabilities might be, for instance, which would also provide an advantage in knowing how to exploit the system for intelligence. One former British official says that it used to be that up to 80% of the Internet went through the US and so was accessible to Fort Meade, making a general point rather than using precise figures. And, they add with a wry smile, The other 20% went through the UK and so was accessible to Fort Meade. Access to global communications at the level of the piping and an understanding of the infrastructure itself was one of the twin pillars of America's home field advantage. This was the 21st century equivalent of Britain's dominance of the global telegraph system at the outbreak of the First World War. Who were the modern versions of those British censors, though? The absence of a handle on the door to room 641A on the sixth floor made Mark Klein suspicious. It looked kind of odd, he thought. Klein was a technician at the San Francisco facility run by the telecoms company AT&T. In January 2003, he saw a new room being built by workmen. Afterwards, it seemed they had installed special equipment inside. When an air conditioner was leaking downstairs from the secret room, regular staff had to wait until special security-cleared technicians could go in. A curious Klein followed the physical path of the cables going into the room and realized they were connecting up to the seventh floor where AT&T handled internet traffic. The building was a key junction or choke point where the communications of AT&T customers were switched and connected to other networks. It was like the building in Hong Kong where the telegraphs came in and the sensors situated themselves to read what passed through in 1914. But this time it was a place with fiber optic circuits connected up. Klein realized that the light carried on the fiber optic cable was being split, effectively copied, and sent into the secret room. Measuring about 24 feet by 48, the room contained several racks of equipment, including a large box. Klein learnt that this was not the only such room in America. Other boxes were being installed in other cities, more than a dozen in all. AT&T responded at the time by saying that it was not permitted by the government to respond to Klein's allegations, but that it vigorously protected its customers' privacy and only shared information as specifically authorized by the law. Some NSA staff, unhappy at developments, have said they wondered why choke points at domestic exchange facilities were chosen as opposed to the landing places for foreign cables. The reason, they thought, was a desire to capture all the traffic, including domestic, rather than just focus on foreign collection. These boxes are the heart, or perhaps they are better described as the brains, of modern computer espionage. When bags of international letters were taken to a building on the Strand in the First World War, 300 examiners would then beaver away in a large, well-lit room. They would examine the address and then, if necessary, open and read a letter with reference to the current set of instructions, a watch list of names and addresses, looking for a match. There were strict rules about the process the examiners were supposed to follow. The idea was to make this as mechanical as possible to speed up the flow while ensuring nothing was missed. The kind of repetitive action based on instructions that Alan Turing had in mind when he first conceived of machines acting with instructions on data. Today, big black boxes sit at internet and communication exchange points in America and around the world. These modern specialized computers do the job of those First World War sensors in an instant. They ingest information at a rate of 10 GBPS, much faster than the poor people in the sorting office could ever manage. But they can also conduct deep packet inspection to read the contents of the mail. A machine, rather than a person, can be instructed either to read the metadata, the address on the envelope of whom it is going to or whom it is from, or the machine can try to open it up and, if they can overcome the tricky task of reassembling distributed data packets, read what is inside. They can match the address against what are known as selectors, the equivalent of the blacklists the human sensors operated. If there is a match, then the message will be flagged up for the next stage, perhaps a person or perhaps another machine. A selector might be an email address or a phone number. In certain cases, it could be a keyword in the content or the signature of a malicious piece of code engaged in a cyber attack. In the First World War, certain items were immediately flagged, for instance, if they were in code or were suspected of using secret inks. The modern equivalent may be a message using encryption, taken by authorities to suggest it is hiding something. There is one other difference. In the First World War, cleared letters were placed in a tin at the end of the room to be taken away by girl guides. They are no longer needed. In the days of the telegraph, Britain had savoured the global reach of its own companies, but also cannily encouraged other countries and companies to have new routes land on British territory scattered over the oceans. Remote, often barely inhabited, rocky outposts like Ascension Island in the South Atlantic became crucial stopping-off points for traffic, providing Britain with a huge strategic advantage in intercepting communications. America's global intercept system relies less on traditional geography and more on the reach of its companies. The installation of U.S. taps in places like San Francisco was just one part of a broader program of bulk access to communications, the origins of which predate 9/11 and which focused on foreign communications. The heart of modern global signals collection system lies in accessing the global telecommunications backbone through which data flows. Known as upstream collection, it has three components. One is access through telecoms companies. Companies, acting under legal compulsion, provide large-scale access to fiber optic cables, switches, or routers around the world, allowing their traffic to be searched for selectors. One program, codenamed Storm Brew, for instance, involved seven access sites at international choke points for global traffic, which passes through the U.S., as well as two submarine cable landing sites in the U.S., one on the east and one on the west coast. The Fairview program dates back to 1985 and is described as being aggressively involved in shaping traffic to run signals of interest past our monitors, implying that communications traffic is deliberately redirected so that it can be intercepted. Blarney goes back to 1978 and provides access to cables, switches, and routers around the world, focusing originally on diplomatic traffic. The code name is perhaps a little joke by Irish Americans, since it is the successor to the Shamrock program that collected cable traffic from the 1970s onwards. Why do companies cooperate? A mixture of reasons, ranging from patriotism to the hard-nosed knowledge that government is often a major customer, especially in defense. Two telecoms companies had contacted the NSA in the days after the attack and asked, "What can we do to help?" One company said it had noticed odd patterns in domestic calling records around the 11th of September 2001. Some companies were less willing, while a few wanted letters from the Attorney General, just as had happened after the Second World War. A 2008 law would provide new legal authority that meant that if the role of companies was revealed or challenged, they could respond by saying that they were simply doing what was required of them. Licenses for cable operators may also include requirements that if foreign operators buy up companies, then special cells of security-cleared Americans will continue to run secret programs. A second method of access is when other governments hand over the traffic or allow access to cables on their turf. The NSA would often build a facility that does the initial processing and then share the results with the host. That country gets the benefit of U.S. technological know-how and massive computer processing power, while the NSA gets its copy of the data for analysis. This is normally done with the condition that neither side will use the information to target the other. The NSA is said to work with 30 countries, including Germany, Israel, Japan, Jordan, South Korea, the UAE, and Saudi Arabia, the U.S. often providing direct funding. the highest recipient being Pakistan, followed by Jordan. These are known as third-party partners. Second-party partners are those members of the Five Eyes Club who already share under their own rules. The final method of collection is unilateral and clandestine cable tapping. This might involve covertly getting inside a country's infrastructure to siphon off data. The US has built submarines with special pods to tap undersea cables, although getting the information out was much harder. Overall, upstream collection provides bulk access to global traffic through the communications infrastructure, maximizing the amount of communications that the NSA can access and run its selectors against to look for matches. The US argues this is not the same as actually collecting the communications in bulk. The selectors are usually things like phone numbers and emails, not keywords like bomb, which would be too broad. Upstream collection focuses on gathering information on non-US persons based abroad as part of the search for different categories of foreign intelligence. How much traffic does NSA access? Overall, it says it touches 1.6% of data on the Internet and only selects 0.025% of that data for review, which is to say that analysts only look at 0.00004% of total Internet traffic. The meaning of figures is often opaque, though, much Internet data being worthless anyway, consisting of music and films, and there are issues over definitions. Intelligence agencies often use the term collect to mean a person reading data rather than a machine siphoning it into a database. But another program made use of home field advantage differently, using the consumer power of American tech companies and exploiting the way in which data had become the currency of the information age. The casinos of Las Vegas and Atlantic City and the credit card companies, rather than the tech companies of Silicon Valley, were among the first to understand the value of data. From the early 1990s, they were at the leading edge of a business trend called database marketing, or, as it later became known, database mining. This grew out of direct marketing and a desire to understand customers by collecting information about their preferences. It has evolved into the modern concept of data mining or big data, which aims to extract useful knowledge hidden within large amounts of information. Casinos wanted to understand what got people gambling, identifying those people for whom a free room or a drinks voucher might lead to greater spending. Tracking someone's behavior by collecting data meant a casino pit boss no longer needed to remember their name or face to give them the special treatment. Instead, a computer knew who they were and what they liked. But casinos wanted to do something else. They also wanted to look for suspicious patterns. So companies tried to build software to find blacklisted gamblers who had been banned but were trying to use fake identities. They also wanted to look for people who might be hiding a relationship with a member of the casino staff which they might abuse to manipulate the system. These early systems proved less capable of plucking people out of thin air than of investigating those who had already come under suspicion, a key distinction that would also exist when the practice transferred over to counter-terrorism. American Express was another early adopter of data. It bought large computers from a company called Thinking Machines to crunch through purchasing patterns and understand consumer habits. From 1993, the UK division of American Express led the way in placing targeted offers on people's billing envelopes, which led to an increase in card spending. It might use computers to find the people who had bought jewellery on a business trip abroad in the last month, for instance. That was suggestive of a certain propensity to spend, which could be useful to know about. This quickly became highly targeted, and the company would sometimes send offers to as few as 20 individuals out of its millions of customers. At first, it took days for computers to process all the data, But soon they speeded up, and more companies, like large retail stores, followed. Companies were learning about moving advertising and marketing away from what was called non-productive reach and instead directing it more towards a specific person's interests, dealing with the famous ad man saying, "Half my advertising is wasted, I just don't know which half." The big supermarkets realized the power and began to set up loyalty card schemes. This would allow habits, preferences, and the minutiae of purchasing patterns to be analyzed in bulk. Promotions and discounts were the reward for handing over information which could help a smart company, with the aid of computers, to understand its customer base better. "Consumers appear to be responding to the precision marketing," Businessweek noted in 1994. But, of course, this private intelligence gathering gives some people the creeps. A credit card statement or a shopping bill could, it emerged, shine a light into almost every part of people's lives. "This was a gold mine," one executive said. The process of having computers churn through all the information was known as drilling down. It was a world reliant on computing power and hungry for data, which might be bought and sold by markets and brokers, and which people willingly, but perhaps unthinkingly, provided when they signed up for cards and filled in their details in return for convenience and discounts. Companies were now doing what the spies had done with large-scale traffic analysis of opponents' communications in the Cold War, building up a large enough data set to extract patterns and meaning and look for irregularities. In the Cold War, only the spy agencies had the computing power, knowledge, and motivation to engage in this kind of large-scale computer-based data collection, and did so in secret. But from the late 1990s, as computing power moved out into the business world, it was becoming possible for others to follow suit and adapt one of the key intelligence collection techniques to the wider world. The spies would then wake up to what was happening in the private sector and the value of the data held not in their own secret basements, but in the outside world. In Smiley's day, the information he needed to piece together clues was mainly in the hands of the government or on paper. Now it was in the hands of companies and on computers. At first, this brought opportunity for spies. Only later would it bring tension. As the new millennium arrived and the internet roared into life, tech companies would learn the value of data better than anyone because they were collecting more than anyone else, and one company came to epitomize this. Back in 1936, Turing had talked of algorithms providing a set of step-by-step instructions for how a machine should treat data. In the late 1990s, Google powered into life on the back of its own unique algorithm to offer people a tool to search the ever-increasing mountain of information on the World Wide Web. The key was the ability to scan the entire web and then organize information and retrieve it based on an understanding of what people were looking for, ranking a page's relevance not just by what was written on it, but its relational value based on what other pages were linked to it. This offered a means of establishing the relative significance of different types of data. The company's Stanford alumni founders, Sergey Brin and Larry Page, worked relentlessly to improve the system by studying user behavior. Could you learn from people's searches whether they had found what they had been looking for, and so improve the system for next time? Other companies like Amazon were also understanding that you could build a business around using customer data to make recommendations. Google soon realized that the data it collected provided a unique insight into people based on their web searches. There were riches in this. In their desire to establish themselves, Google and other tech companies offered their services for free, perhaps intending to charge eventually. And consumers liked that and soon came to expect it. But someone had to pay for it all. And that was advertisers. And what the data offered was a chance to take the database marketing techniques to a new level in understanding consumers to target advertisements towards their interests. This was first done with the web searches, and the company realized it was gold dust. People's searches opened a window into their lives, their interests, aspirations, and fears. The next step came when Google moved into developing its own email communications system. The company explored using its computers to scan people's communications to target advertising better. When a Californian politician proposed a law to opt out of such targeted advertising, she was approached by Page and Brin. She later recounted the encounter in a PBS TV documentary. All of a sudden, Sergei started talking to me. He said, "Senator, how would you feel if a robot went into your home and read your diary and read your financial records, read your love letters, read everything, but before leaving the house, it imploded?" And he said, "That's not violating privacy." I immediately said, "Of course it is. Yes, it is." And he said, "No, it isn't. Nothing's kept. Nobody knows about it." I said, "That robot has read everything. Does that robot know if I'm sad or if I'm feeling fear or what's happening?" And he looked at me and he said, "Oh no, that robot knows a lot more than that." This was the new world of computers automatically analyzing the vast data flows of individuals. It was machines talking to machines. But what if the robot did not explode and some of the data could be retained? The more data you have and hold on to, the more you can do with it. This was becoming the business model of the new internet era. As time went on, other technological trends aided the process. The cost of data storage fell, making it economic to keep more information. The relative cost of computing power fell as well, making it economic to process it. And the places in which data was being collected expanded as our use of the internet and computers moved beyond just email and web searches into a much more integral part of our daily lives. A new world of apps would emerge which would collect vast amounts of user data, both for their own functions but also for advertisers. As early as 2004, Google executives were reported as nervous about what would happen if the NSA realized how much they had data they could have access to. The fact that companies were collecting rich data on people was not a truth likely to be lost on the state. For a start, there was the principle of it. If a company could automatically scan communications to sell advertising, why should the government not do it to protect national security, they argued. But there was also a practical point. If the companies had all this data, why not piggyback on their collection and try to get access to it? After all, the targets of intelligence agencies use the internet like everybody else. And so corporations would become the, not always willing, agents of state intelligence collection. The first pillar of America's home field advantage lay in the way it had built much of the infrastructure and controlled the digital world's piping and cabling. This facilitated upstream collection. The second lay in the fact that it was also American companies that people used to send communications and data through those pipes. The majority of known terrorist email addresses the NSA has tracked are hosted on U.S.-based providers or foreign-managed providers hosted on servers in the United States, a draft NSA report said. The volume of individual requests in the form of legal demands for data on foreign suspects served on companies like Microsoft, Google, and Yahoo began to grow from 2001. Information from the accounts of suspects proved important in counter-terrorist inquiries in the UK, such as those of a known Al-Qaeda operative, Deerin Barrett, picked up in 2004, as well as the men arrested for planning a fertilizer bomb the same year. But as the burden on companies increased, so did their discomfort. This led to demands for a more streamlined process and new legal authorities, which came in the 2008 Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA. PRISM was the result. This compelled companies to help the government acquire foreign intelligence information on non-US targets believed to be abroad. Where upstream demanded access to the telecoms companies carrying global traffic, PRISM used the same provisions to demand help from the companies who provided the services that people used, companies like Microsoft, Google, and Yahoo. PRISM was not a secret backdoor way for the NSA to break into tech companies, although there was that as well. Companies insist they only allow front door access, in other words, legally enforceable demands for their users' data. PRISM was, in effect, more of a discreet side entrance that the companies had to provide so that the NSA could enter, but without the public seeing them come in through the front. And it was the FBI who did the entering on behalf of the NSA. The system was designed to facilitate the transfer of material that the US government was asking for on specific foreign suspects, and to do so by increasing the level of automation in that transfer, in a sense, by outsourcing some of the effort to where the data lay. This involved providing the companies with selectors, for instance, an email address, which they had to run in-house across their data, offering up the results. The companies insist they had to approve these requests individually. The spies were tapping into the global ascendancy of American technology firms and the companies' hunger for people's data. This secret was kept incredibly tight, even within the companies, with only a tiny handful of people aware. And they did not know it was called PRISM. PRISM did not just provide access to communications as they moved, but also data as it was stored, data at rest. The trend in recent years has been to give your data to the big companies like Microsoft and Google to store and process on their servers, known slightly misleadingly as the cloud. That meant this treasure trove was also becoming accessible. More than 9 out of 10 internet communications with the NSA acquired each year were obtained through PRISM. Caspar Bowden was not one of those in on the secret when he worked at Microsoft. He had fought on the British fronts of the 1990s crypto wars to push back against state control before becoming chief privacy advisor for Microsoft. It was a role that involved advising the different national technology officers for the company who operated in individual countries. He had been one of the few to suspect what the 2008 legalization might mean and became worried about how it might secretly be implemented when it came to a broad category of data belonging to foreigners that touched the US in some way. During an internal strategy conference in Europe in 2011, he says he voiced his concerns. If you sell Microsoft cloud computing to your own governments, then this law, FISA 2008, means that the NSA can conduct unlimited mass surveillance on that data, he told the assembled group. A senior executive turned green and the room fell silent, he later recalled. During the coffee break, he was warned about speaking out. 2 months later, Bowden left the company. He would go on to campaign vocally on the issue. PRISM's access to the tech company's data could provide everything from surveillance of live email and chat through to files and photos, and even real-time notification when someone logged in or sent a message. PRISM became the leading source of material for the NSA, accounting for nearly 1 in 7 intelligence reports and, along with upstream collection, contributing to more than a quarter of all reports on terrorism. As of September 2012, 45,000 selectors were going through PRISM, up 32% on the previous year. The acquisition of data begins with the targeting of a known individual rather than trawls using keywords to find suspects. Forms of keyword searching are more possible in upstream but not PRISM. But the scale of what was now possible was transformative. Together, Upstream and PRISM allowed the US government to target a much wider range of foreigners than was possible in the past, and to do it with much greater flexibility. Those individuals did not need to be involved in terrorism, but just have some knowledge of a suspected terrorist or fall into other broad categories certified by a court, such as someone reasonably believed to be likely to communicate designated types of foreign intelligence. The number of targets steadily increased from the passing of the 2008 law. By 2013, the programs targeted 89,138 people. This was home field advantage. The information collected by these systems flows into databases accessible not just by the NSA, but also by the CIA and FBI, who can also make requests to task certain selectors for collection. All of this data can be kept and then searched or queried by analysts. The NSA's intelligence analysts conduct at times complex queries across large data sets, an oversight report notes. Data in itself is not enough without the tools to analyze it, and these were evolving. Hunting terrorists was less like breaking Enigma or performing traffic analysis against Soviet codes, and more like the kind of spy hunting of the Cold War, seeking out fragments and piecing them together. This process of investigating connections and looking for links has been transformed by computers. The problem spies faced in the digital age was not a lack of leads, but a tidal wave of data. What was crucial was finding tools that would allow you to find meaning within it all. In a Cold War spy hunt, like a police investigation, everything was done with pen and paper and charts up on a wall, the type seen in crime procedural dramas. In a murder inquiry, these would allow you to visualize the array of suspects and contacts and how they might be connected to each other and the victim, often through billing records and other associations. Complex engineering projects, like the construction of nuclear missiles back in the 1950s, pioneered the use of what were known as PERT, Program Evaluation Review Technique, charts, to visualize complex networks and events over time. These were then adopted by law enforcement agencies in the 1960s to try to bring together all the data about an event. One of the earliest uses was by LAPD in the investigation into the assassination of Robert Kennedy. The charts could be up to 30 feet long, and a new piece of information would require rubbing things out and moving bits of paper around. An officer from the Metropolitan Police brought some of these ideas back to the UK in the 1980s, and thinking began about whether computers could be used to visualize this data. In 1990, a British company called i2 was founded in Cambridge. It used graphic drawing tools to display a spider's web of contacts and associations on a computer. This network analysis might reveal new leads to follow or unravel a complex financial web. Almost immediately after the company showed off its product at conferences and exhibitions, the intelligence community in the US and the UK approached it for their own version. Their eagerness came because their own tools were good at processing 100 million records, but not at extracting meaning in a user-friendly way. Both MI5 and the FBI had been wasting vast amounts of money on databases and computer systems that had never really worked in previous years and would continue not to do so. The i2 system did not just reveal static connections, but looked at how they evolved over time. It could answer the who, what, and when questions an investigator might have, although perhaps not the why. Crucially, in the mid-1990s, digitization meant that phone companies were, for the first time, able to keep detailed call records for itemized billing. This provided a gold mine for police that would transform their work. i2 would become the equivalent of Microsoft Word for the intelligence and law enforcement agencies who would plug into their databases. The world of computer analytics was now meeting counterterrorism. By 2000, the system had been able to look for patterns, but processing still limited its capacity to do complex work against the largest datasets. But by about 2005, the kinds of systems i2 had built were able to test out more advanced algorithms and patterns to do what is now called big data. For instance, a computer could spot that if A calls B, then B calls C, and C calls D, and this happens every Tuesday afternoon, there is a pattern. This kind of pattern analysis in turn can be predictive. If the data says A has called B every Tuesday afternoon, then they are likely to do the same again, and if they do not, that in itself might be revealing. In 2011, IBM bought i2 for a reported $500 million. The idea of correlating fragments of data and looking for patterns was explored immediately after 9/11 in a controversial project run by John Poindexter, a former U.S. national security advisor. It had an ominous name, Total Information Awareness, TIA. This was different from the initial post-9/11 NSA system, which was based around getting hold of big troughs of domestic data like phone records and then querying them with specific numbers, link analysis, uncovering associations and connections. What Poindexter had talked of was data mining, using algorithms to wade through combined sets of data to find patterns and anomalies. This offered the possibility that you could make predictions about behavior rather than just follow a known trail to find unknowns. Poindexter had talked of a Manhattan Project for countering terrorism, based on the idea that terrorists emitted a characteristic data signature, like the acoustic trail a Soviet submarine might leave as it tries to move silently through the oceans. TIA involved bringing together records of all kinds of domestic data, like credit card billing and travel patterns, which would be correlated to find a signature. For instance, what kind of travel patterns might typically constitute reconnaissance by a terrorist cell. These would then be applied back to the vast mass of data to find others like them. The processing power did not quite exist when it was conceived, though, and crucially, it was not clear that the signatures were going to be possible to find. The project was quickly junked after a public outcry over privacy when it was revealed in 2003. Poindexter resigned. TIA died, but the idea behind it had not. One former NSA official recalled going to hear General Keith Alexander talk when he was running the Army's Information Dominance Center in the early 2000s. He had all these diagrams showing how this guy was connected to that guy and to that guy, the former official later told a journalist. Some of my colleagues and I were skeptical. Later, we had a chance to review the information. It turns out that all that those guys were connected to were pizza shops. But slowly, the spies learned the lessons. After Alexander became head of the NSA, he would push harder. It is a lot easier to build a network chart of someone's contacts if you can start with their Facebook profile. This is all a reflection of the new world in which so much valuable intelligence is open source. In other words, it is not secret or classified. Its power comes when it is cross-referenced with other data, just as it was in the days of Cold War spy hunting. The difference is there is much more data, and it is computerized, and therefore easy to collate, although one challenge was that it was in the hands of the private sector. Analyzing all this open-source information is almost a new intelligence function in itself, but has fallen to the secret intelligence agencies. Is accessing this material spying or not? A rich picture could be built up on someone without ever having to do anything that used to be considered spying. But if you take open-source and add in secret information, then you have even more. In 2010, the NSA received permission to build analysis of American people's contacts through combining its metadata with other publicly and commercially available sources, like Facebook or bank details, allowing domestic contact chaining as long as there was a foreign intelligence purpose. Previously, this had been barred as too intrusive. At first, computers had struggled to cope with the sheer volume of data on offer. The link charts that came out the other side were meaningless spaghetti rather than anything more instructive. The NSA again learned from the tech companies in dealing with the mass of information. The ability to search across multiple databases and combine the results in a meaningful way was the next crucial step. From 2007, after in-house attempts proved less successful, the NSA began using a distributed system, Acumulo, that could analyze trillions of data points from different sources. It could then look for connections and establish the significance of these. This was based around Hadoop, which grew out of Google's work and was used by Facebook and other companies. Visa had used it to reduce the time needed to process 73 billion transactions from 1 month to just 13 minutes. And so the idea of finding meaning in the vast sea of data began to turn into something more than an elusive dream. Spying was meeting the new world known as big data.